Welcome to Lessons in Tanya, Chapter 24. Have you ever paused, I mean, really stopped, to consider what happens to our deepest spiritual connection, that kind of fundamental bond we have to the divine when we slip up? You know, even with what feels like a really minor misstep? Or maybe you've wondered if there's some kind of, I don't know, secret hierarchy of what constitutes bad in the grand spiritual design of things? Well, today we're embarking on a really profound deep dive into chapter 24 of Tanya. It's an ancient and honestly utterly fascinating text, and this chapter. It reveals some truly radical insights into the very nature of transgression, the intricate relationship between our soul and the divine. Plus, it presents some surprising, maybe even humbling comparisons to elements we might instinctively think are, well, far below us in the scheme of things. So our mission today is to meticulously unpack this chapter, trying to extract its deepest nuggets of understanding. We want to give you, the listener, a genuine shortcut to being truly well-informed on this ancient wisdom, but, you know, with all the unexpected twists and paradigm shifts that make this text so compelling. And just for context, this entire body of material springs from the profound teachings of a truly venerable sage, often known simply as the Alter Rebbe.
Yeah, and what's really fascinating here is how this particular chapter doesn't just stand alone, you know. It builds directly on concepts we've explored in previous deep dives. It actually creates a crucial counterpoint, deepening our understanding of everything that came before, and adds a whole new layer. So for those who joined us previously, or maybe for anyone just dipping their toes into this wisdom now, chapter 18, for instance, it unveiled this really profound truth. Serving the divine, acting out of pure love and awe, it's accessible to absolutely everyone. It's not some, like, exclusive practice reserved for the spiritual elite, not at all. It's really about awakening a deep, hidden love for the divine that's just inherently latent within each and every one of us.
Yeah.
And this hidden love, it's truly foundational. It acts as the bedrock, really, for our connection and for observing all the divine commandments.
Right, that hidden love, the core potential within everyone.
Exactly. And then, remember in chapter 23, we expanded dramatically on the concept of divine unity. Mm-hmm. Now, this isn't just the, you know, the standard theological idea that there's only one divine being. No, it's a much more radical, all-encompassing idea that the divine is essentially the only existing being, the absolute totality of reality. Everything else we perceive, you know, every single thing in existence, from the biggest galaxy down to the tiniest particle, is actually contained within the divine.
Yeah.
It's utterly nullified to its source, kind of like a sunbeam within the sun itself.
Completely absorbed.
Completely absorbed. So the audacious assertion that anything exists truly separate from the divine, even if it's just implied, is considered, from this viewpoint, a form of idolatry, because it fundamentally denies that ultimate all-encompassing unity. It's like saying there's a reality outside the divine, which from this perspective just isn't possible.
Makes sense.
And of course, a core takeaway from that discussion was that through observing divine commandments, those specific actions and pathways where the divine will is perfectly revealed and through engaging in divine study, one achieves a perfect, profound union with the divine. It's a direct connection, a true merging with the ultimate reality.
Okay, so we've just spent time really delving into this incredible concept of union, right? This deep connection we get when we observe the divine will, when we align ourselves. But here's where chapter 24 takes this unexpected turn, a really thought-provoking leap, actually. It effectively flips the script entirely. It meticulously explains the exact opposite effect of observing a divine commandment. So while a divine commandment, a positive act, joins you to the divine and profoundly affirms that divine unity, a transgression, and this is absolutely key, even a seemingly minor one, fundamentally severs you from the divine, cuts that connection.
A complete break.
Yeah. And this is the radical, almost shocking implication that the text really drives home. It asserts that any transgression, doesn't matter how small or insignificant it might seem to us, carries within it an implication, a subtle echo of idolatry.
Wow, that's a strong statement.
It's incredibly strong. It suggests that any act contrary to the divine will, because that will is perfectly unified with the divine's very essence, remember, inherently carries this echo of denying the divine's ultimate unity and soul existence. It's almost like by doing something contrary to the divine will, you are just in that moment subtly asserting that there's a separate will, maybe a separate reality, that can operate independently.
Which from this perspective is the essence of idolatry.
Exactly. It's seen as a form of spiritual treason, if you will, a fundamental break, not just, you know, a little stumble.
Right. And to connect this to the, let's say, the broader architecture of existence, the text introduces this profound concept, the existence of what it calls unholy realms. Mm-hmm. You can think of these as a kind of spiritual counterpart, like a mirror image in the spiritual landscape, to holiness itself.
So like a shadow world.
In a way, yes. The text suggests that just as everything in the realm of holiness has its corresponding aspect, there's also this opposing force, a kind of spiritual negative space, and this counterpart to holiness. It's manifested in the 365 prohibitions found in ancient scripture, and also in all the prohibitions established later by the ancient wise ones.
Okay, so all the don'ts, basically.
Essentially, yes. But the core idea here is absolutely crucial. These prohibitions aren't just like inconvenient rules or arbitrary tests. No, the text clarifies they are intrinsically contrary to, and the very opposite of, the divine will and wisdom. They are, in their very essence, a denial of divine unity.
So they inherently represent separation.
Exactly. Because they stand in direct opposition to the divine's essence through its pure unifying will, they inherently represent total and complete separation from the divine's unity and oneness. And the text goes even further, explicitly stating that these unholy realms are themselves referred to as idolatry and other divinities.
That's intense. Not just like idolatry, but our idolatry.
That's the language used. It's because the internal aspect of the divine will, the divine's inner purpose and light, is profoundly concealed from them, hidden. Instead, they receive their life force, their very existence, from what's called the hinder part of the divine will. Imagine maybe the divine's light shining through an incredibly dense, opaque filter. The light is still the source, it's still there, but its inner warmth, its direct purpose, is so obscure
that what comes through seems different.
Exactly. What emerges on the other side appears as something distinct, maybe even separate. This allows them to perceive themselves, or be perceived, as entities separate from the divine, hence the term other divinities.
Yeah.
They're sustained by the divine, ultimately, but they don't consciously embody its inner unified purpose.
Okay, so if that's the nature of these unholy realms, what does this profound idea mean for us, personally, on our journey? The text makes it powerfully clear, doesn't it? It's not just the forbidden actions themselves that cause this radical separation.
No, it goes deeper.
Right. The text talks about what it calls the garments of the animal soul. These garments are our thought, our speech, and our action. The very ways our inner self manifests and interacts with the world around us.
Our interface with reality.
Exactly. And when these garments, when our very thoughts, words, or deeds become involved in violating any of the divine prohibitions, whether they're direct commands from scripture or rulings from the wise ones, they become completely united, like fused even, with these unholy realms, with idolatry.
So our actions drag us into that realm.
But here's the really critical and honestly quite shocking point the text makes. Not only do our actions, thoughts, and words unite with these unholy forces, but in that precise moment, the human soul itself and its garments become secondary. They become subordinate, and this is the kicker, much lower and more debased than these unholy realms themselves.
Lower than the source of impurity itself.
That's what it says. Think about that for a second. It means that a human who transgresses through their conscious choice, actually descends to a level below the very spiritual impurity they're engaging with.
That's quite a spiritual demotion.
It really is. It suggests our inherent dignity, our connection, is momentarily overshadowed, dragged down by the very forces we align with through that transgression.
Wow. Okay, this brings us to a really important and I think quite unsettling question. How can a human being who sins possibly be lower than the very spiritual impurity or unholy realms that are themselves called idolatry? It feels like a paradox, doesn't it? It seems almost counterintuitive.
It really does.
Well, the text explains this by revealing a crucial distinction, a fundamental difference in their actual nature. See, the unholy realms, despite their inherent opposition to holiness, aren't clothed in a physical body like we are.
Ah.
And this means, somewhat ironically, they are more exposed to the direct radiance of divine light than a being confined to a material existence. There's less insulation, maybe?
Interesting. So less shielded.
In a way. And crucially, the text says, even these unholy realms inherently know their master. They recognize their ultimate source. They don't rebel against the divine independently, out of their own, like, free will. Any evil act attributed to them, any destructive force they embody, is performed only in the service of the divine's ultimate plan. It's part of a larger, often hidden, divine orchestration.
So they're like tools, in a sense, albeit negative ones.
You could see it that way. To give you a powerful example from ancient texts, think about that figure, Balaam, the sorcerer who wanted to curse the Israelites. Even he, a seemingly negative force, declared, and this is a direct quote, I cannot violate the word of the divine.
Even him.
Even him. It demonstrates that even these deeply negative forces, these unholy realms, operate strictly within a divine framework.
Right.
They cannot truly defy the divine will or its ultimate purpose. So even though they're called idolatry and are, in a sense, a denial of the divine because their internal life force sees itself as separate, they still refer to the divine as the divine of divinities, which indicates a fundamental recognition deep down that their very life and existence ultimately derive from divine will. They are bound by the divine's ultimate purpose. They simply cannot, by their very nature, violate the divine will. Their rebellion is inherent in their structure, not in active defiance like ours can be.
Okay, let's really try to unpack this paradox the text is laying out here. It's quite something. If these unholy realms, the very source of spiritual impurity, are inherently constrained, right? They can't truly rebel against the divine will because their existence utterly depends on it. Then what does that say about us when we as humans do choose to violate that will?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
It really is. And the conclusion the text draws is both profound and, frankly, deeply humbling. It posits that the person who does violate divine will through their conscious, deliberate choice is actually greatly inferior, far more debased than these unholy realms or spiritual impurity.
Which are called idolatry and other divinities.
Exactly. Think about the implication there. A human sinner, in that moment of transgression, is separated completely from the divine's unity and oneness even more radically than these unholy realms themselves.
Because it's a choice, a conscious act of defiance.
Precisely. The text suggests it's because the human acts as though they deny divine unity in a far more profound volitional way. Our capacity for deliberate defiance, our unique free will to choose against the divine, places us in this uniquely precarious spiritual position. It's as if, by choosing to rebel, we actively carve out a deeper spiritual chasm than naturally exists in those realms.
That's a heavy responsibility that comes with free will.
It is. And this profound separation, the text explains, is similar to what's described in other ancient texts, which picture evil in this physical world as like the dregs or the sediment of the coarsest spiritual impurity, like the absolute remnants after any sparks of good have been painstakingly extracted.
Like the sludge, the bottom after everything pure is gone.
Exactly. Imagine a perfectly clear, pure liquid, and all the nourishment and light have been carefully siphoned off, leaving only the densest, darkest sludge at the very bottom. This, the text suggests, is why, as ancient wisdom observes, all matters of this world are harsh and evil, and the wicked prevail in it.
Because this physical realm, at least in its lowest manifestations, is infused with the lowest, most debased forms of this spiritual impurity, the very residue of defiance.
It's a sobering perspective on the nature of our world.
It truly is. So given this really radical understanding of separation, this idea that our transgression severs us even more profoundly than the unholy realms themselves, a fundamental question just jumps out. Why? Why do people transgress at all? It seems so utterly counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Yes.
Especially if, as we learned earlier, every fiber of our being secretly yearns for connection with the divine.
Right. It feels like we should be running towards connection, not away from it.
Exactly. So the text introduces a critical concept to address this seemingly inexplicable human behavior. It quotes the ancient wise ones. No man commits any transgression unless a spirit of folly has entered into him. The wise ones directly link the idea of a person turning aside from the divine path with folly.
Yeah.
Simple foolishness.
So it's not necessarily malice. It's foolishness.
It's presented less as deliberate malice or a conscious, complete rejection of the divine, and more as a temporary spiritual blindness, a profound foolishness that allows the transgression to happen, like a mental and spiritual fog rolls in.
Okay, a spirit of folly. And to really get a handle on this, let's look at that specific, vivid example the text uses, the case of an adulterous woman.
Right.
The text explains that even someone who might have a frivolous nature, you know, someone not typically seen as having profound self-control or deep spiritual resolve, even they should theoretically be able to control their passionate drives. There's a baseline expectation, right? Basic self-mastery.
You'd think so.
However, the text asserts that the profound obstacle, the very reason she succumbs to temptation, is precisely this spirit of folly within her. The spirit acts like a veil, covering, concealing, obscuring that hidden love that resides deep within her divine soul.
That same hidden love we talked about earlier.
Exactly. And remember, this hidden love is that innate yearning we all have. It's described as a profound, unwavering desire to cling to faith in the divine, to cling to divine unity, fiercely resisting any separation, even to the point of sacrificing one's very life rather than practicing idolatry.
Even just bowing outwardly without belief.
Right, even that. So the paradox of choice here is really striking. If this hidden love is powerful enough to enable her to face death, to willingly sacrifice her life to avoid idolatry, it should certainly, logically, be able to overcome what seems like the lighter suffering or challenge of resisting sexual temptation. It seems like a lesser battle.
Logically, yes. But she transgresses.
She transgresses. So the spirit of folly must be working at a really fundamental level to obscure this powerful innate drive toward connection. It has to be clouding her judgment profoundly.
That's precisely the point the text is making, and it's such a crucial insight into human behavior, I think. The text suggests the only way she could commit such an act is if she genuinely believes, in that moment of folly, that her sin won't tear her away from the divine in the same radical, absolute way that idolatry would.
Ah, so she makes a distinction in her mind.
Exactly. This subtle distinction she makes, this perception that one transgression is somehow far more heinous or severing than the other, that itself is also a direct manifestation of this spirit of folly.
Hmm.
And where does that folly come from? It stems directly from those unholy realms we discussed earlier. It's their influence clouding her perception.
So the folly isn't just allowing the sin, it's also creating this false hierarchy of sins in her mind.
Precisely. This spirit of folly makes her insensitive, maybe even numb, to the enormous breach, that's the term used, that every single sin creates between herself and the divine. If she were truly aware, truly sensitive to this profound, immediate separation, this total severance it causes in that moment,
they wouldn't do it.
She would undoubtedly be able to overcome the desire and refrain from the sin. It's not presented as a fundamental lack of innate love for the divine, but rather as a temporary spiritual insensitivity, a profound foolishness masking the true severity of the act, allowing passion or desire to triumph over her inherent spiritual clarity.
Okay. And what's really fascinating here is where this spirit of folly actually operates within the soul, and crucially, where it can't reach.
Right, the limits of its power.
Yeah. The text tells us that the spirit of folly envelops the divine soul only up to a certain point. Significantly, it does not include, it cannot penetrate the soul's faculty of wisdom.
And that faculty of wisdom, as we touched on before.
Right. It represents the inherent, unwavering power of faith in the divine, our bedrock belief. This is why our fundamental faith remains ultimately unaffected by the spirit of folly. It's explained as being because of the pure divine light that is intrinsically clothed within this deepest faculty of wisdom. It acts like an unassailable stronghold, a safe room for faith.
Ah, so that explains the paradox.
Exactly. This profound insight helps explain that paradox we discussed earlier. When a person is directly confronted with something that unequivocally touches their core faith, like the demand for idolatry, the spirit of folly is rendered powerless. In that moment, the unblemished faith residing in the faculty of wisdom shines through with absolute clarity, and the person would indeed sacrifice their life to avoid that transgression.
Because the core isn't clouded?
The core isn't clouded. But with other temptations, maybe like adultery or other seemingly minor sins, where the spirit of folly can conceal this fundamental faith, and the powerful hidden love.
Then one might succumb.
Then unfortunately, one succumbs. So the subjective distinction that a person might make between various sins is therefore exposed by the text as pure foolishness. It's a trick of the spirit of folly, a temporary spiritual delusion.
Because the underlying reality is...
Because the underlying reality, the unifying truth, the stark reality remains. Even what we perceive as a minor sin violates the divine will and causes a complete separation from divine unity. A separation, the text emphasizes again, even more radical and profound than that associated with the unholy realms themselves, precisely because of that element of human choice, that conscious turning away.
Wow. Okay, so if we sort of zoom out again, expand our perspective and connect this to the bigger picture, the text takes this whole concept of spiritual degradation a startling step further.
Mm-hmm.
It introduces a truly humbling, almost unsettling comparison.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. It suggests that a person who sins is, at the very moment of that transgression, lowered to a spiritual standing, even below the lowest creatures in the animal kingdom.
Below animals.
Below even the lowest. The text brings up an ancient saying from the wise ones, passed down through generations. When a person sins, they are told, the gnat preceded you.
The gnat.
The gnat. Now, the simple meaning might just be a lesson in humility, right? Even a lowly gnat was created before you, so don't get too big for your boots.
Okay, that makes sense on one level.
But the deeper spiritual meaning, as Tanya reveals it, goes way beyond just chronology. It's not just about who came first in the order of creation. It's about rank. It's about one's spiritual standing and the nature of their connection, or lack thereof, to the divine.
That's a truly arresting statement. How on earth can a gnat, that tiny, seemingly insignificant creature, possibly be higher or spiritually superior to a human being, even a human who has sinned?
Yeah, it requires explanation. The text explains this by using the gnat as a really potent symbol for a very specific type of spiritual impurity. Its nature, as described in ancient texts, is that it consumes but does not excrete.
Okay. Biologically, maybe, but spiritually.
Right. It's not just biology. It's a profound spiritual metaphor. It symbolizes an extreme form of selfishness, a being that only takes, only receives, but gives nothing back, contributes nothing.
Total taker.
Total taker. This is described as the lowest form of spiritual impurity, utterly removed from holiness, which is inherently characterized by giving, by outflow, by self-nullification, and humility.
Okay, so the gnat represents extreme spiritual selfishness.
Exactly. Yet even this lowest form of spiritual impurity, symbolized by the gnat, precedes the human sinner in the order of descent of the divine life force.
Wait, precedes meaning it's higher up?
Meaning it derives its life force from a higher level of divinity than the sinner does at the moment of transgression.
How can that be?
Why? Because even the gnat, in its inherent selfish nature, perfectly fulfills the divine will for its existence. It does what a gnat is supposed to do. It does not choose to defy its purpose.
Ah, it's aligned with its created purpose, even if that purpose seems base to us.
Precisely. That is a truly startling revelation. It suggests that even in its base form, the gnat is in perfect alignment with its created purpose, unlike the human who possesses the capacity to choose to deviate and does so.
So it's about alignment versus chosen misalignment.
Got it. And this isn't limited to just gnats. The text explicitly states that other unclean creatures, and even ferocious beasts, are spiritually above the sinner at the moment of transgression.
Why them too?
For the same simple but profoundly illuminating reason. All these creatures do not deviate from their divinely intended purpose. They inherently obey the divine command embedded within their very existence. While an animal itself might not consciously perceive the divine command like a human could.
Right.
The life force animating them is inherently aware of the divine will. It doesn't permit them to act in violation of it. Their very spirit perceives it, as the text puts it. There's a deep, innate alignment.
That's fascinating. Like their spiritual GPS is locked onto the divine plan.
Something like that. And this concept is also reflected in that ancient scriptural verse from Genesis, the one that speaks of the fear and dread of humans lying upon every beast of the earth. The ancient wise ones comment on this, saying that a wild beast will never defy a human being unless he appears to it like an animal.
Meaning, if the human loses their divine image.
Exactly. As long as a person retains their divine image, their spiritual integrity, their connection to the divine will, even the fiercest animal will recognize that spark and submit. Think about that powerful story, the anecdote of Daniel in the lion's den.
Right, the lions didn't touch him.
Not only did they not harm him, the tradition says they humbled themselves before him. Why? Because righteous individuals who retain that divine image on their face and embody divine will can handle even dangerous beasts. They recognize the divine spark. This stands in stark contrast to the sinner, who, by choosing defiance, temporarily erases that divine image and descends below the very creatures that inherently obey.
Wow. So when we connect all this to the broader picture of existence, it becomes incredibly clear, almost starkly clear. Even animals, in their basic nature, do not violate the divine will in the way a human can and sometimes does.
Hmm.
The chilling summary here, delivered pretty bluntly by the text, is that a person who sins, who transgresses the divine will, even with a minor offense, is, at the very moment of that act, completely removed from the divine holiness, meaning the divine's absolute unity and oneness, even more so than all the unclean creatures, vermin, and reptiles that derive their sustenance from the unholy realms and spiritual impurity associated with idolatry.
It really is a humbling thought.
It's profoundly humbling and maybe unsettling that our unique capacity for free will, when we misuse it to transgress, can lead to a spiritual descent even below what we might consider the lowest, most instinct-driven forms of life. It really highlights that it's our conscious choice that makes all the difference.
Okay, so let's unpack this a bit further, because this deep dive is definitely challenging a lot of common assumptions about right and wrong, about the severity of actions. You, the listener, might be thinking, wait a minute, hold on. If every sin causes such a profound, immediate separation from the divine if it's all kind of on the same level of ultimate separation in that moment?
Right. If it's all absolute severance.
Then yes. How do we explain the legal principles, the actual divine commandments themselves, that seem to differentiate between sins? For example, why does the law clearly state that saving a human life overrides most divine prohibitions?
Like working on the day of rest.
Exactly. But it does not override the prohibitions of idolatry, certain forbidden relationships like incest and murder. You have to give up your life rather than do those.
That certainly looks like a hierarchy. It seems to imply a clear difference in severity in the eyes of the divine.
It does look that way on the surface. And that's a truly vital question. The text addresses this apparent contradiction directly, and I think profoundly. The fact that saving a life overrides other prohibitions is not about the sin's intrinsic lightness or gravity at all. That's not the measuring stick being used there.
Okay, so what is the principle then?
It's a completely different principle we'll apply, one that speaks to the very purpose of the divine commands themselves. Let's take that familiar example, desecrating the day of rest in order to save a life. The ancient wise ones explain this seemingly contradictory allowance with a really profound statement. They say, the divine instruction declares, desecrate one day of rest for his sake so that he may live to observe many days of rest.
Ah, so it's about future observance.
Precisely. This isn't a waiver because the command for the day of rest is somehow less important or less holy, not even close. Rather, it means the divine precept is not being waived due to some external leniency or lower status. Instead, it's actually in the interest of the precept itself specifically, the future observance of that very precept, that a temporary violation is allowed.
So saving the life serves the commandment in the long run.
Exactly. The very purpose of saving the life is to enable that person to continue observing divine commandments, including many, many future days of rest. The command itself is so essential that allowing a temporary tactical suspension for the sake of its continued observance by that living individual is actually seen as part of its deeper will. It's a strategic override, not a devaluation.
Okay, that shifts the perspective significantly.
It really does. And to further support the idea that this is not about inherent severity during the act, consider this contrast. Desecrating the day of rest is considered an incredibly grave offense in Jewish law, so severe that it's even comparable to idolatry in some specific legal contexts, for example, regarding the laws of ritual slaughter if someone habitually violates it.
Wow. Very serious, then.
Extremely serious. Yet, saving a life unequivocally overrides the day of rest. Conversely, certain forbidden sexual relationships are generally considered less grave in terms of, say, direct spiritual penalties than desecrating the day of rest. Yet they are not overridden by saving a life. One is compelled to sacrifice their life rather than engage in them.
So the overriding factor doesn't line up with the perceived severity at all.
Not at all. Therefore, the text concludes, the requirement or non-requirement to sacrifice one's life for a prohibition cannot be used as a measure of the relative intrinsic gravity or badness of divine commandments in that moment of transgression. It is purely what the text calls a scriptural decree, a specific divine instruction that determines its practical application in extreme circumstances, rather than an indication of a sin's inherent weight or a perceived hierarchy of evil during the act itself. The gravity during the act remains absolute severance for all transgressions.
Okay. So what does this all mean for our perception then, for our day-to-day understanding of sin and temptation? The text seems to be making a crucial, really profound distinction here, and it brings us right back to that deceptive influence of the spirit of folly, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
The person who does distinguish between the gravity of various transgressions in the moment, you know, being willing to sacrifice their life to avoid idolatry, but not even bothering to restrain their desire for other forbidden acts, is still operating under the pervasive influence of this spirit of folly. They're still caught in that fog.
Their perception is skewed.
Right. This folly once again obscures their hidden love for the divine, and it blinds them to the ultimate truth. Why? Because the absolute unwavering truth, according to Tanya chapter 24, remains that every single transgression, whether we perceive it as major or minor, creates the ultimate and complete separation between the sinner and the divine at the moment of the act. Full stop.
No gradations in that moment.
No gradations in that moment of severance.
Yeah.
Any mental distinction made at that critical point, any perceived hierarchy of severity during the act itself, is just a product of this spiritual blindness. It's a profound misperception caused by the spirit of folly shrouding their awareness of their deeper connection and the true nature of divine unity.
Okay, but what's truly fascinating here, and maybe offers a bit more nuance, is that while all sins create this immediate ultimate separation during the act,
yes,
differences do emerge after the sinful act has actually occurred. The consequences, the after effects, are not uniform.
Okay. So the separation is total during, but the aftermath varies.
Exactly. The text makes a crucial distinction between sins that carry the penalty of spiritual extinction of the soul, or death by heaven, terms indicating a complete severing of the divine soul from its source, like a permanent spiritual cutoff.
Right, the really severe ones.
And other sins. For those sins that do not carry such a severe extinguishing penalty, the connection to the divine isn't utterly irrevocably severed forever. It's described as being merely weakened or blemished.
So damaged but not destroyed.
Damaged but not destroyed. This is a crucial differentiation. The immediate impact during the act is total separation, absolute severance. But the long-term spiritual state, and importantly, the potential for rectification, for repair, can vary significantly depending on the nature of the transgression.
Okay, that makes more intuitive sense with legal distinctions.
Right. And corresponding to the extent and the specific nature of the blemish caused by the sin, there are various purifying processes and punishments described in tradition. These might occur either in a spiritual realm, something akin to purgatory, or through suffering and challenges in this very world. But the profound insight here is that the purpose of this spiritual purification or punishment is not primarily punitive, not in the sense of retribution or divine revenge.
So what is it for?
It's purely for cleansing, for removing the stain, the spiritual residue that the sin has left upon the soul, preparing it for a renewed, maybe even stronger, connection. It's restorative, not just retributive.
Okay, let's unpack this message of hope then, this potential for return, even after these really challenging insights about the depth of separation. So, even after committing a sin, provided, of course, it's one that doesn't cause that ultimate spiritual extinction we just talked about.
Right, assuming it's not one of those.
The animal soul and the body can return. They can rise from the unholy realms, from that spiritual impurity where they descended during the act. They can begin to draw closer once again to the holiness of the divine soul that's still within them. This implies there's a clear path back, right? A way to lift oneself out of that spiritual abyss.
Absolutely. There's always a path through repentance.
And here's a really beautiful, almost comforting, steadfast point the text emphasizes. The divine soul itself always believes in the one divine. It remains profoundly faithful, even while the sin is being committed.
Its core remains pure.
Its core remains pure. The text clarifies it is the animal soul, acting through the body, that actually performs the sinful act. But the divine soul's core faith, its very essence, remains unshaken. It's just held captive, maybe. Obscured.
That's a good way to put it. Obscured, overwhelmed temporarily.
However, the text is clear. During the act of sin, the divine soul is indeed in a state of veritable exile within the animal soul. And that animal soul is deriving its energy from the unholy realm at that moment. So this animal soul drags the body down to a level even lower than the impurity of the unholy realms or idolatry themselves.
It's a temporary spiritual imprisonment for the divine soul.
Yeah, a profound obscuring of its light, even if temporary.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, this exile of the divine soul during sin is described in the text as the greatest humiliation imaginable. It uses really strong imagery.
What kind of imagery?
The text uses this vivid and profoundly powerful analogy to convey the depth of this humiliation. It says it's like seizing the king's head.
The king's head representing...
Representing the divine soul, right? Because it stems from divine wisdom, which is seen as the ultimate spiritual source, the head, the expression of divine unity. So it's like seizing the king's head and then violently dragging it down, dipping its precious face into filth. And that filth represents the unholy realms and spiritual impurity.
That's incredibly graphic.
It is. This analogy really stresses the profound humiliation brought upon the soul, the divine spark within us, by sin. Even if this spiritual debasement is only for a moment, because as we discussed, the soul can rise afterward through repentance and purification.
Right, the potential for return is there.
The act itself is described as an ultimate affront, a moment of profound spiritual desecration that speaks to the very core of our being and our connection. It really highlights the immense spiritual cost of transgression and the incredible sensitivity of our bond to the divine.
Okay, so let's bring this all together. What does this all mean for you, our listener, as you navigate your daily life, your choices, your spiritual journey? This deep dive into chapter 24 has really shown us that the apparent differences between various sins, you know, in terms of their legal consequences or how we might perceive their severity, seem to apply primarily after the sin has been committed, during the process of rectification, of cleansing, of purification.
That's where the distinctions matter more.
Right. But the truly crucial unifying message, the core takeaway, seems to be this. During the act itself, every single sin, whether we deem it big or small in our human estimation, creates a profound and complete separation from the divine, total severance in that moment.
Mm-hmm. The break is absolute.
And here's the powerful, practical application of this wisdom, and it connects right back to what we learned in earlier chapters about that hidden love. Remember, since every single individual is endowed with a deep, hidden love for the divine, that innate yearning to be constantly united and never separated, not even for a fleeting moment.
That core desire.
This hidden love is actually our greatest tool. It's our most potent weapon against transgression. By truly internalizing this profound understanding, the understanding that any sin, no matter how insignificant it seems on the surface, leads to a separation even more radical than the unholy realms themselves.
Yeah.
One can learn to employ this hidden love, to awaken it, to recoil from every sin with the exact same intensity and unwavering resolve as they would from the unthinkable thought of idolatry.
Treating every temptation as an attack on that core connection.
Exactly. It's about recognizing that every transgression, no matter how seemingly minor, is a direct assault on our inherent love for the divine and our foundational faith in divine unity. It becomes an opportunity to awaken that dormant love and let it guide our choices, making us sensitive to any breach.
That's a very powerful way to frame it. This deep dive into Tanya chapter 24, it really does challenge our common perceptions, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Our usual categories of good and bad and the impact of the seemingly minor actions in our lives. It reveals that our inner spiritual state, that hidden connection to the divine, is far more sensitive, far more intricately interconnected with the fabric of reality than we often imagine.
It really does feel that way after exploring this.
So maybe consider this as a closing thought. If even the unholy realms themselves cannot truly rebel against the divine will, if they are bound within that ultimate plan, and if even animals instinctively follow their divinely ordained purpose, what unique responsibility and indeed what profound potential for connection does that place on us? As human beings with our incredible unique capacity for conscious choice and free will.
It puts our free will in such a different light.
How might recognizing this profound unity of transgression, the idea that any break is a total break in the moment, and also recognizing the steadfast, faithful nature of our hidden divine soul, how might that awareness transform your approach to daily choices and spiritual growth?
It really reframes everything. This understanding feels like a powerful call to reevaluate what true folly actually means in our lives and to consciously, actively harness that innate love for connection that resides so deeply within each and every one of us.
It's about leveraging that love.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive. It's been quite a journey through some challenging but ultimately illuminating ideas. Until next time, keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep connecting.